Welcome to Season 4, Episode 5 of Chill with a Chapter Book. I'm Allison from the Wells Public Library, and this season we're reading The Secret Garden by Frances Hodgson Burnett. Chapter 10, Dickon. The sun shone down for nearly a week on the secret garden. The secret garden was what Mary called it when she was thinking of it. She liked the name. And she liked still more the feeling that when its beautiful old walls shut her in, no one knew where she was. It seemed almost like being shut out of the world in some fairy place. The few books she had read and liked had been fairy story books, and she had read of secret gardens in some of the stories. Sometimes people went to sleep in them for 100 years, which she had thought must be rather stupid. She had no intention of going to sleep, and, in fact, she was becoming wider awake every day which passed at Misselthwaite. She was beginning to like to be out of doors. She no longer hated the wind, but enjoyed it. She could run faster and longer, and she could skip up to 100. The bulbs in the secret garden must have been much astonished. Such nice, clear places were made round them that they had all the breathing space they wanted, and really, if Mistress Mary had known it, they began to cheer up under the dark earth and work tremendously. The sun could get at them and warm them, and when the rain came down, it could reach them at once, so they began to feel very much alive. Mary was an odd, determined little person, and now she had something interesting to be determined about. She was very much absorbed indeed. She worked and dug and pulled up weeds steadily, only becoming more pleased with her work every hour instead of tiring of it. It seemed to her like a fascinating sort of play. She found many more of the sprouting pale green points than she had ever hoped to find. They seemed to be starting up everywhere, and each day she was sure she found tiny new ones, some so tiny that they barely peeped above the earth. There were so many that she remembered what Martha had said about the snowdrops by the thousands, and about bulbs spreading and making new ones. These had been left to themselves for 10 years, and perhaps they had spread, like the snowdrops, into thousands. She wondered how long it would be before they showed that they were flowers. Sometimes she stopped digging to look at the garden and try to imagine what it would be like when it was covered with thousands of lovely things in bloom. During that week of sunshine, she became more intimate with Ben Weatherstaff. She surprised him several times by seeming to start up behind him as if she sprang out of the earth. The truth was that she was afraid that he would pick up his tools and go away if he saw her coming, so she always walked toward him as silently as possible. But, in fact, he did not object to her as strongly as he had at first. Perhaps he was secretly rather flattered by her evident desire for his elderly company. Then, also, she was more civil than she had been. "How long has that been here?" he jerked out. "I think it's about a month," she answered. "Tha's beginning to do Misselthwaite credit," he said. "Tha's a bit fatter than tha was, and tha's not quite so yeller. Tha looked like a young plucked crow when tha first came into this garden. Thinks I to myself, I never set eyes on an uglier, sourer-faced young'un." Mary was not vain, and as she had never thought much of her looks, she was not greatly disturbed. "I know I'm fatter," she said. "My stockings are getting tighter. They used to make wrinkles. Oh, there's the robin, Ben Weatherstaff." There, indeed, was the robin, and she thought he looked nicer than ever. His red waistcoat was as glossy as satin, and he flirted his wings and tail, and tilted his head, and hopped about with all sorts of lively graces. He seemed determined to make Ben Weatherstaff admire him. But Ben was sarcastic. "Aye, there thou art," he said. "Tha can put up with me for a bit sometimes when tha's got no one better. Tha's been reddening up thy waistcoat and polishing thy feathers these 2 weeks. I know what tha's up to. Tha's courting some bold young madam somewhere, telling thy lies to her about being the finest cock robin on Missile Moor and ready to fight all the rest of 'em." "Oh, look at him!" exclaimed Mary. The robin was evidently in a fascinating, bold mood. He hopped closer and closer and looked at Ben Weatherstaff more and more engagingly. He flew on to the nearest currant bush and tilted his head and sang a little song right at him. "Tha thinks thou'll get over me by doing that," said Ben, wrinkling his face up in such a way that Mary felt sure he was trying not to look pleased. "Tha thinks no one can stand out against thee, that's what tha thinks." The robin spread his wings. Mary could scarcely believe her eyes. He flew right up to the handle of Ben Weatherstaff's spade and alighted on the top of it. Then the old man's face wrinkled itself slowly into a new expression. He stood still as if he were afraid to breathe, as if he would not have stirred for the world, lest his robin should start away. He spoke quite in a whisper. "Well, I'm danged," he said, as softly as if he were saying something quite different. "Tha does know how to get at a chap, tha does. Tha's fair unearthly, tha's so knowin'." And he stood without stirring, almost without drawing his breath, until the robin gave another flirt to his wings and flew away. Then he stood looking at the handle of the spade, as if there might be magic in it. And then he began to dig again and said nothing for several minutes. But because he kept breaking into a slow grin now and then, Mary was not afraid to talk to him. "Have you a garden of your own?" she asked. "No, I'm but shelter and lodge with Martin at the gate." "If you had one," said Mary, "what would you plant?"
"Cabbages and taters and onions."
"But if you wanted to make a flower garden," persisted Mary, "what would you plant?"
"Bulbs and sweet-smelling things, but mostly roses."
Mary's face lighted up. "Do you like roses?" she asked. Ben Weatherstaff rooted up a weed and threw it aside before he answered.
"Well, yes, I do. I was learned that by a young lady I was gardener to. She had a lot in a place she was fond of, and she loved 'em like they was children, or robins. I've seen her bend over and kiss 'em."
He dragged out another weed and scowled at it.
"That were as much as 10 year ago."
"Where is she now?" asked Mary, much interested.
"Heaven," he answered, and drove his spade deep into the soil, according to what Parson says.
"What happened to the roses?" Mary asked again, more interested than ever. They was left to themselves. Mary was becoming quite excited.
"Did they quite die? Do roses quite die when they are left to themselves?" she ventured.
"Well, I got to like 'em, and I liked her, and she liked 'em," Ben Weatherstaff admitted reluctantly. "Once or twice a year I'd go and work at 'em a bit, prune 'em and dig about the roots. They run wild, but they was in rich soil, so some of 'em lived."
"When they have no leaves, and they look gray and brown and dry, how can you tell whether they are dead or alive?" inquired Mary.
"Wait till the spring gets at 'em. Wait till the sun shines on the rain and the rain falls on the sunshine, and then they'll find out."
"How?" cried Mary. "How?" forgetting to be careful.
"Look along the twigs and branches, and if tha see a bit of a brown lump swellin' here and there, watch it after the warm rain and see what happens." He stopped suddenly and looked curiously at her eager face.
"Why does tha care so much about roses and such all of a sudden?" he demanded.
Mistress Mary felt her face grow red. She was almost afraid to answer.
I want to play that I have a garden of my own," she stammered.
There is nothing for me to do. I have nothing and no one."
"Well," said Ben Weatherstaff slowly, as he watched her, "that's true, tha hasn't."
He said it in such an odd way that Mary wondered if he was actually a little sorry for her. She had never felt sorry for herself. She had only felt tired and cross, because she disliked people and things so much. But now the world seemed to be changing and getting nicer.
If no one found out about the secret garden, she should enjoy herself always. She stayed with him for 10 or 15 minutes longer and asked him as many questions as she dared. He answered every one of them in his queer, grunting way, and he did not seem really cross and did not pick up his spade and leave her. He said something about roses just as she was going away, and it reminded her of the ones he had said he had been fond of. "Do you go and see those other roses now?" she asked. "Not been this year. My rheumatics has made me too stiff in the joints." He said it in his grumbling voice, and then quite suddenly he seemed to get angry with her, though she did not see why he should. "Now look here," he said sharply. "Don't that ask so many questions? Thou'rt the worst wench for asking questions I've ever come across. Get thee gone and play thee. I've done talking for today." And he said it so crossly that she knew there was not the least use in staying another minute. She went skipping slowly down the outside walk, thinking him over and saying to herself that, queer as it was, here was another person whom she liked in spite of his crossness. She liked old Ben Weatherstaff. Yes, she did like him. She always wanted to try to make him talk to her. Also, she began to believe that he knew everything in the world about flowers. There was a laurel-hedged walk which curved around the secret garden and ended at a gate which opened into a wood in the park. She thought she would skip round this walk and look into the wood and see if there were any rabbits hopping about. She enjoyed the skipping very much, and when she reached the little gate, she opened it and went through because she heard a low, peculiar whistling sound and wanted to find out what it was. It was a very strange thing indeed. She caught quite her breath as she stopped to look at it. A boy was sitting under a tree with his back against it, playing on a rough wooden pipe. He was a funny-looking boy, about 12. He looked very clean, and his nose turned up and his cheeks were as red as poppies, and never had Mistress Mary seen such round and such blue eyes in any boy's face. And on the trunk of the tree he leaned against, a brown squirrel was clinging and watching him, and from behind a bush nearby, a cock pheasant was delicately stretching its neck to peep out, and quite near him were two rabbits, sitting up and sniffing with tremulous noses. And actually, it appeared as if they were all drawing near to watch him and listen to the strange low little call his pipe seemed to make. When he saw Mary, he held up his hand and spoke to her in a voice almost as low as and rather like his piping. "Don't thou move," he said. "It'd flight 'em." Mary remained motionless. He stopped playing his pipe and began to rise from the ground. He moved so slowly that it scarcely seemed as though he were moving at all. But at last he stood on his feet, and then the squirrel scampered back up into the branches of his tree, the pheasant withdrew his head, and the rabbits dropped on all fours and began to hop away, though not at all as if they were frightened. "I'm Dickon," the boy said. "I know thou'rt Miss Mary." Then Mary realized that somehow she had known at first that he was Dickon. Who else could have been charming rabbits and pheasants as the natives charm snakes in India? He had a wide, red, curving mouth, and his smile spread all over his face. "I got up slow," he explained, "because if thou makes a quick move, it startles 'em. A body has to move gentle and speak low when wild things is about." He did not speak to her as if they had never seen each other before, but as if he knew her quite well. Mary knew nothing about boys, and she spoke to him a little stiffly because she felt rather shy. "Did you get Martha's letter?" she asked. He nodded his curly, rust-colored head. "That's why I come." He stooped to pick up something which had been lying on the ground beside him when he piped. "I've got the garden tools. There's a little spade and rake and a fork and hoe. They are good uns. There's a trowel, too. And the woman in the shop threw a packet of white poppy and one of blue larkspur when I bought the other seeds.
Will you show the seeds to me? Mary said.
She wished she could talk as he did. His speech was so quick and easy. It sounded as if he liked her and was not the least afraid she would not like him, though he was only a common moor boy, in patched clothes and with a funny face and a rough, rusty red head. As she came closer to him, she noticed that there was a clean, fresh scent of heather and grass and leaves about him, almost as if he were made of them. She liked it very much, and when she looked into his funny face with the red cheeks and round blue eyes, she forgot that she had felt shy.
"Let us sit down on this log and look at them," she said.
They sat down, and he took a clumsy little brown paper package out of his coat pocket. He untied the string, and inside there were ever so many neater and smaller packages with a picture of a flower on each one.
"There's a lot of mignonette and poppies," he said.
"Mignonette's the sweetest smelling thing as grows, and it'll grow wherever you cast it, same as poppies will. Them as'll come up and bloom if you just whistle to 'em, them's the nicest of all."
He stopped and turned his head quickly, his poppy-cheeked face lighting up.
"Where's that robin as is calling us?" he said. The chirp came from a thick holly bush, bright with scarlet berries, and Mary thought she knew whose it was.
"Is it really calling us?" she asked.
"Aye," said Dickon, as if it was the most natural thing in the world.
"He's calling someone he's friends with. That's same as saying, 'Here I am, look at me, I wants a bit of a chat.' There he is in the bush. Whose is he?"
"He's Ben Weatherstaff's, but I think he knows me a little," answered Mary.
"Aye, he knows thee," said Dickon in his low voice again. "And he likes thee. He's took thee on. He'll tell me all about thee in a minute."
He moved quite close to the bush with the slow movement Mary had noticed before, and then he made a sound almost like the robin's own twitter. The robin listened a few seconds intently and then answered quite as if he were replying to a question.
"Aye, he's a friend of yours," chuckled Dickon.
"Do you think he is?" cried Mary eagerly. She did so want to know. "Do you think he really likes me?"
"He wouldn't come near thee if he didn't," answered Dickon. "Birds is rare choosers, and a robin can flout a body worse than a man. See, he's making up to thee now. Cannot thee see a chap?" he's saying.
And it really seemed as if it must be true. He so sidled and twittered and tilted as he hopped on his bush.
"Do you understand everything birds say?" said Mary.
Dickon's grin spread until he seemed all wide, red, curving mouth, and he rubbed his rough head.
"I think I do, and they think I do," he said. "I've lived on the moor with 'em so long, I've watched 'em break shell and come out and fledge and learn to fly and begin to sing, till I think I'm one of 'em. Sometimes I think perhaps I'm a bird or a fox or a rabbit or a squirrel or even a beetle, and I don't know it."
He laughed and came back to the log and began to talk about the flower seeds again. He told her what they looked like when they were flowers. He told her how to plant them and watch them and feed and water them.
"See here," he said suddenly, turning round to look at her. "I'll plant them for thee myself. Where is the garden?"
Mary's thin hands clutched each other as they lay on her lap. She did not know what to say, so for a whole minute she said nothing. She had never thought of this. She felt miserable, and she felt as if she went red and then pale.
"Tha's got a bit of garden, hasn't tha?" Dickon said.
It was true that she had turned red and then pale. Dickon saw her do it, and as she still said nothing, he began to be puzzled.
"Wouldn't they give thee a bit?" he asked. "Hasn't thou gotten any yet?"
She held her hands tighter and turned her eyes toward him.
"I don't know anything about boys," she said slowly. "Could you keep a secret if I told you one?
It's a great secret. I don't know what I should do if anyone found it out. I believe I should die.
She said the last sentence quite fiercely. Dickon looked more puzzled than ever, and even rubbed his hand over his rough head again, but he answered quite good-humoredly.
"I'm keeping secrets all the time," he said. "If I couldn't keep secrets from the other lads, secrets about foxes' cubs and birds' nests and wild things' holes, there'd be naught safe on the moor. I can keep secrets."
Mistress Mary did not mean to put out her hand and clutch his sleeve, but she did.
"I've stolen a garden," she said very fast. "It isn't mine. It isn't anybody's. Nobody wants it. Nobody cares for it. Nobody ever goes into it. Perhaps everything is dead in it already. I don't know."
She began to feel hot and as contrary as she had ever felt in her life.
"I don't care. I don't care. Nobody has any right to take it from me when I care about it, and they don't. They're letting it die all shut in by itself," she ended passionately, and she threw her arms over her face and burst out crying. Poor little Mistress Mary.
Dickon's curious blue eyes grew rounder and rounder.
He said, drawing his exclamation out slowly, and the way he did it meant both wonder and sympathy.
"I've nothing to do," said Mary. "Nothing belongs to me. I found it myself, and I got into it myself. I was only just like the robin, and they wouldn't take it from the robin."
"Where is it?" asked Dickon in a dropped voice.
Mistress Mary got up from the log at once. She knew she felt contrary again, and obstinate, and she did not care at all. She was imperious and Indian, and at the same time hot and sorrowful.
"Come with me and I'll show you," she said.
She led him round the laurel path and to the walk where the ivy grew so thickly. Dickon followed her with a queer, almost pitying look on his face. He felt as if he were being led to look at some strange bird's nest and must move softly. When she stepped to the wall and lifted the hanging ivy, he started. There was a door, and Mary pushed it slowly open, and they passed in together, and then Mary stood and waved her hand round defiantly.
"It's this," she said. "It's a secret garden, and I'm the only one in the world who wants it to be alive."
Dickon looked round and round about it, and round again.
"Eh," he almost whispered. "It is a queer, pretty place. But it's like as if a body was in a dream."
Chapter 11. The Nest of the Missel Thrush. For 2 or 3 minutes he stood looking round him, while Mary watched him, and then he began to walk about softly, even more lightly than Mary had walked the first time she had found herself inside the four walls. His eyes seemed to be taking in everything, the gray trees with the gray creepers climbing over them and hanging from their branches, the tangle on the walls and among the grass, the evergreen alcoves with the stone seats and all flower urns standing in them.
"I never thought I'd see this place," he said at last in a whisper.
"Did you know about it?" asked Mary. She had spoken aloud, and he made a sign to her.
"We must talk low," he said, "or someone will hear us and wonder what's to do in here."
"Oh, I forgot," said Mary, feeling frightened and putting her hand quickly against her mouth.
"Did you know about the garden?" she asked again when she had recovered herself.
Dickon nodded.
"Martha told me there was one, as no one ever went inside," he answered. "Us used to wonder what it was like."
He stopped and looked round at the lovely gray tangle about him, and his round eyes looked queerly happy.
"Ah, the nest as'll be here come springtime," he said. "It'd be the safest nest in place in England. No one never come in near, and tangles of trees and roses to build in. I wonder all the birds on the moor don't build here." Mistress Mary put her hand on his arm again without knowing it.
"Will there be roses?" she whispered. "Can you tell? I thought perhaps they were all dead."
"Eh, no, not them, not all of them," he answered. "Look here." He stepped over to the nearest tree, an old, old one with gray lichen all over its bark, but upholding a curtain of tangled sprays and branches. He took a thick knife out of his pocket and opened one of its blades.
"There's lots of dead wood as ought to be cut out," he said, "and there's a lot of old wood, but it made some new last year. This here's a new bit."
And he touched a shoot which looked brownish green instead of hard, dry gray. Mary touched it herself in an eager, reverent way.
"That one?" she said. "Is that one quite alive? Quite?"
Dickon curved his wide, smiling mouth. "It's as wick as you or me," he said. And Mary remembered that Martha had told her that wick meant alive or lively.
"I'm glad it's wick," she cried out in her whisper. "I want them all to be wick. Let's go round the garden and count how many wick ones there are."
She quite panted with eagerness, and Dickon was as eager as she was. They went from tree to tree and from bush to bush. Dickon carried his knife in his hand and showed her things which she thought wonderful.
"They've run wild," he said, "but the strongest ones has fair thrived on it. The delicatest ones has died out, but the others has growed and growed and spread till they's a wonder. See here."
And he pulled down a thick, gray, dry-looking branch.
"A body might think this was dead wood, but I don't believe it is, down to the root. I'll cut it low down and see."
He knelt and with his knife cut the lifeless-looking branch through, not far above the earth.
"There," he said exultantly. "I told thee so. There's green in that wood yet. Look at it."
Dickon went and knelt down by them, smiling his wide smile.
"Thou was right," he said. "A gardener couldn't have told thee better. They'll grow now like Jack's beanstalk. They're crocuses and snowdrops, and these here's narcissuses," turning to another patch. "And here's daffydowndillies. Ah, they will be a sight."
He ran from one clearing to another.
"Tha has done a lot of work for such a little wench," he said, looking her over.
"I'm growing fatter," said Mary, "and I'm growing stronger. I used always to be tired. When I dig, I'm not tired at all. I like to smell the earth when it's turned up."
"It's rare good for thee," he said, nodding his head wisely. "There's not as nice as the smell of good clean earth, except the smell of fresh growing things, when the rain falls on them. I get out on the moor many a day when it's raining, and I lie under a bush and listen to the soft swish of drops on the heather, and I just sniff and sniff. My nose end fair quivers like a rabbit's, mother says."
"Do you never catch a cold?" inquired Mary, gazing at him. She had never seen such a funny boy, or such a nice one.
"Not me," he said, grinning. "I never catched cold since I was born. I wasn't brought up nesh enough. I've chased about the moor in all weathers, same as the rabbits does. Mother says I've sniffed up too much fresh air for 12 years to ever get to sniffin' with cold. I'm as tough as a white thorn knobstick."
He was working all the time he was talking, and Mary was following him and helping him with her fork or the trowel.
"There's a lot of work to do here," he said once, looking about quite exultantly.
"Will you come again and help me to do it?" Mary begged. "I'm sure I can help too. I can dig and pull up weeds and do whatever you tell me. Oh, do come, Dickon."
"I'll come every day if thou wants me, rain or shine," he answered stoutly. "It's the best fun I ever had in my life, shut in here and wakening up a garden."
"If you will come," said Mary, "if you will help me to make it alive, I don't know what I'll do," she ended helplessly. "What could you do for a boy like that?"
"I'll tell thee what thou'll do," said Dickon with his happy grin.
They'll get fat and they'll get as hungry as a young fox, and they'll learn how to talk to the robin same as I do. We'll have a lot of fun. He began to walk about, looking up in the trees and at the walls and bushes with a thoughtful expression. I wouldn't want to make it look like a gardener's garden, all clipped and spick and span, would you? He said. It's nicer like this, with things running wild and swinging and catching hold of each other. Don't let us make it tidy, said Mary anxiously. It wouldn't seem like a secret garden if it was tidy. Dickon stood rubbing his rusty red head with a rather puzzled look. It's a secret garden, sure enough, he said. But seems like someone besides the robin must have been in it since it was shut up 10 years ago. But the door was locked and the key was buried, said Mary. No one could get in. That's true, he answered. It's a queer place. Seems to me as if there'd been a bit of pruning done here and there later than 10 years ago. But how could it have been done? Said Mary. He was examining a branch of a standard rose, and he shook his head. Aye, how could it? He murmured. With the door locked and the key buried. Mistress Mary always felt that however many years she lived, she should never forget that first morning when her garden began to grow. Of course, it did seem to begin to grow for her that morning. When Dickon began to clear places to plant seeds, she remembered what Basil had sung at her when he wanted to tease her. "Are there any flowers that look like bells?" she inquired. "Lilies of the Valley does," he answered, digging away with the trowel. "And there's Canterbury bells, and campanellas." "Let's plant some," said Mary. "There's Lily of the Valley here already. I saw 'em. They'll have grown too close, and we'll have to separate 'em, but there's plenty. The other ones take 2 years to bloom from seed, but I can bring you some bits of plants from our cottage garden. Why dost thou want 'em?" Then Mary told him about Basil and his brothers and sisters in India, and how she had hated them, and of their calling her Mistress Mary quite contrary. "They used to dance round and sing at me. They sang, 'Mistress Mary, quite contrary, how does your garden grow? With silver bells and cockle shells and marigolds all in a row.' I just remembered it, and it made me wonder if there were really flowers like silver bells." She frowned a little and gave her trowel a rather spiteful dig into the earth. "I wasn't as contrary as they were." But Dickon laughed. "Eh," he said, and as he crumbled the rich black soil, she saw he was sniffing up the scent of it. "There doesn't seem to be no need for no one to be contrary when there's flowers and such like, and such lots of friendly wild things running about making homes for themselves, or building nests and singing and whistling, does there?" Mary, kneeling by him holding the seeds, looked at him and stopped frowning. "Dickon," she said, "you are as nice as Martha said you were. I like you, and you make the fifth person. I never thought I should like 5 people. Dickon sat up on his heels as Martha did when she was polishing the grate. He did look funny and delighted, Mary thought, with his round blue eyes and red cheeks and happy-looking turned-up nose. "Only 5 folk as thou likes?" he said. "Who is the other 4? "Your mother and Martha," Mary checked them off on her fingers, "and the robin and Ben Weatherstaff." Dickon laughed so that he was obliged to stifle the sound by putting his arm over his mouth. "I know thou thinks I'm a queer lad," he said, "but I think thou art the queerest little lass I ever saw." Then Mary did a strange thing. She leaned forward and asked him a question she had never dreamed of asking anyone before. And she tried to ask it in Yorkshire, because that was his language, and in India a native was always pleased if you knew his speech. "Doesn't thou like me?" she said. "Eh," he answered heartily, "that I does. I likes thee wonderful, and so does the robin, I do believe." "That's 2, then," said Mary. "That's 2 for me." and then they began to work harder than ever and more joyfully. Mary was startled and sorry when she heard the big clock in the courtyard strike the hour of her midday dinner. "I shall have to go," she said mournfully. "And you will have to go too, won't you?" Dickon grinned. "My dinner's easy to carry about with me," he said. "Mother always lets me put a bit of something in my pocket." He picked up his coat from the grass and brought out of a pocket a lumpy little bundle tied up in a quite clean, coarse, blue and white handkerchief. It held two thick pieces of bread with a slice of something laid between them. "It's often as not but bread," he said, "but I've got a fine slice of fat bacon with it today." Mary thought it looked like a queer dinner, but he seemed ready to enjoy it. "Run on and get thy victuals," he said. "I'll be done with mine first. I'll get some more work done before I start back home." He sat down with his back against a tree. "I'll call the robin up," he said, "and give him the rind of the bacon to peck at. They likes a bit of fat wonderful." Mary could scarcely bear to leave him. Suddenly, it seemed as if he might be a sort of wood fairy who might be gone when she came into the garden again. He seemed too good to be true. She went slowly halfway to the door in the wall, and then she stopped and went back. "Whatever happens, you would never tell?" she said. His poppy-colored cheeks were distended with his first big bite of bread and bacon, but he managed to smile encouragingly. "If thou was a missel thrush and showed me where thy nest was, does thou think I'd tell anyone?" "Not me," he said. "Thou art as safe as a missel thrush." And she was quite sure she was.